This is WGN Radio Chicago, where it's time now for Extension 720. Here is your host and moderator, Milton Rosenberg.
And it is indeed a great pleasure to welcome back to the program Rabbi Harold Kushner, who was here about 4 years ago, I guess it was.
That's right, and I remember the evening very fondly, both you and the very classy group of listeners and callers in that you had that night. And I have to tell you, Milt, I'm doing a fair amount of radio now with my new book. Nobody gave me the kind of introduction you just gave me, this mellifluous, highly articulate, polysyllabic introduction and summary of what the book is about. You're wonderful.
Well, you realize you've just rendered me mute for the rest of the evening. I won't be able to talk at all now. Well, the book moves me and concerns me as it would anybody over 50, and I confess I am. I'm not sure whether you are. You're around there.
I'm just turned 51 last week.
There you are.
I turned 50 as I was writing the book. With the last book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, if I did 100 interviews, 98 of them started, Rabbi Kushner, tell us about the personal tragedy that motivated you to write this book. It was the book that grew out of our son's illness and death. If anybody asks me with the new book, tell us about the tragedy that provoked you to write this book, it was turning 50.
Uh-huh. In the book, I want to jump right into it. One of the chapters is titled, The Most Dangerous Book in the Bible. And lest anybody have any doubt, that is, of course, the book of Ecclesiastes.
You say, of course. I think it's probably news to a few of your listeners.
Well, it is the most pessimistic book in either the Old Testament or the New.
It's
well,
a
rabbi,
unique
voice. I should say, in either the Bible or...
Either the Hebrew Bible
the Hebrew
or the
Bible
New Testament,
or
right?
The New Testament, right.
I'm not sure I'd go along with calling it pessimistic.
Vanity of vanities. Yeah. All is vanity.
It's a desperate book. I don't think... The guy comes across, the guy who wrote it, as sour on life, but I feel such a sense of kinship with him. It's why I've made him the hero and the model of my new book, that I think I can read his soul. And what I find there is not so much pessimism, but desperation verging on despair.
You've got some of the right quotes. Here's one. I think you've got this from a modernized version of the Old Testament.
It's the recent Jewish Publication Society translation. Yeah. I think it's a 1982 publication.
In my own brief life, I have seen this, that a good man perishes in spite of his goodness, and a wicked man endures in spite of his wickedness. So do not exert yourself to be especially good, for you may be dumbfounded. Which is to say, there's no justice.
That's right. Now, you're right.
In this life or after it.
Nobody in the Bible talks like that except Ecclesiastes. It is an unmistakable tone. The cynicism, the skepticism, the pervasive sense of futility. What he's saying is, nothing I do makes any difference. It doesn't make any difference if I'm a good person or a bad one. It doesn't make any difference if I'm learned or foolish, if I'm obedient or rebellious. Why? Because one of these days I'm going to die. And everything I did on earth will vanish with me. Nothing in the long run, nothing endures. So what's the point of living?
And if you want to add to that, even before I die, others that I value will die. And if I am lucky enough to live long enough, I will find that I am forgotten, and that the works in which I took some participation and for which I had some pride have come to nothing. We are all transient travelers through this veil of tears, and we are not remembered. Unless we are persons of great historic significance, then if we're remembered, we're more often cursed than blessed.
I think so. As a congregational rabbi, I've seen a lot of people very sick. I've sat by their bedsides as they knew they were slipping into death. I think I've learned something. People are not afraid of dying. They're not afraid of dying. They're afraid of not having lived. The person who feels he has used his time well, that he's really figured out what it means to be human, faces the prospect of death with some measure of equanimity. The person who says, I never really got it right, and now I never will because I'm not going to live that long, that's the person who panics. And this is what I find in Ecclesiastes. I hear him saying, I'm not sure I lived right. And that's why I'm afraid that death will come and cancel everything. Nothing I did will last. And if nothing lasts, what was the point of it? If it's simply a brief flash to be forgotten, why have we labored so hard? Why do we get so upset about justice and injustice? Why do we get so upset about doing right? In the long run, we're all going to be dead. So why should I knock myself out to be honest? Why don't I just take the easy way out?
It's interesting to me, you must have noted, that we've already been talking for perhaps 6 or 8 minutes. I don't think the word happiness has been uttered yet. Yet usually when you ask what's life about, or what's the point of life and what's one's purpose in life, it is to find and retain happiness. Though that's a very limited view, I'm sure you would agree.
Well, it's kind of a nebulous term. The stinger is that you don't become happy by pursuing happiness. The Declaration of Independence, to the contrary, notwithstanding, we have the right to the pursuit of happiness, but because it's a political document and not a spiritual one, it never tells you that pursuing happiness is the wrong way. Happiness is always a byproduct. I think of the happiest people I know, and they're not the ones who buy the books and take the courses about how to be happy, and they're probably not the richest ones and not the most famous and not the most envied. They're the people who never think about happiness. They think only about how to be a mensch, how to be a good, fully realized human being. They think about being somebody's friend and somebody's neighbor, about being a faithful worker. And happiness kind of sneaks in when they're not looking. You know, there's a wonderful Hasidic story. Actually, it's not Hasidic, but that's a technicality, about the rabbi who says to one of the prominent members of his flock, "Whenever I see you, you're always running around. Where are you running all the time?" And the man says, "I'm running after prosperity. I'm running after success. I'm running after making a living. That's where I'm running." The rabbi says, "That's a good answer if you assume that all those good things are ahead of you and you're chasing after them to catch them. Maybe they're behind you trying to catch up with you, and the more you run, the harder you make it for them to find you. Maybe there are all sorts of wonderful things trying to catch up with us, but we're never home for them to be delivered."
I'll match that story with another one, and I'm rather vague about its source. I know it's in Herodotus, but I'm rather vague as to who says it to what Persian king. Somebody says it to either Xerxes or Darius, who has had a great victory, and everything has gone wonderfully well, and he's watching the victorious troops pass by, and someone, I guess it's Xerxes or Darius himself, says, "This is the happiest moment of my life," and the wise observer standing by says, "Sire, never count any man happy until he is dead," meaning you don't know what misfortune is yet to come.
That's right. I remember that story. It's one of the memorable pages in Herodotus. Yeah. And if I remember, the end of the story is that before he dies, something terrible
dreadful
happens to him,
and he
dies in sheer misery.
Right.
And yet, I think that story assumes a very limited definition of happiness, Milt. Happiness means everything working out for you. I did a funeral a couple of months ago for an elderly woman in my congregation who died at a ripe old age, and I spoke of her as having had a full life. Not a good life, and not an easy life, but a full life. And I defined a full life as full of love and full of pain, full of achievement and full of frustration. This is a woman who had had her son die in her lifetime, who had seen her husband lose his sense of self with Alzheimer's, who had become very sick and senile and lost her mind, who had been wealthy at one time and lost it all and had lived in poverty and struggled very hard to put it together again.
Full indeed, full of all the miseries of human existence.
No, that's just the point. Full of the misery and full of the satisfactions. Because, you know, I'm convinced that you can't have one without the other. Mm-hmm. If there is perhaps one plague which keeps people from being happy today, it's that we are so afraid of being hurt by life that we go around with a constant suit of emotional armor so that nothing will hurt us. It's like the two young people who sat in my office a couple of years ago. They were going to get married, and they wanted to meet me and go over the ceremony. And after we're talking for a while, the young man says, "Rabbi, would you be willing to make one small change in the wedding service? Instead of pronouncing us husband and wife till death do us part, would you pronounce us husband and wife for as long as our love lasts?" Mm. We've talked about this, and we've decided if we ever get to the point where we don't love each other, we don't think it's morally right for us to be stuck with each other.
That almost guarantees that they will get to that point, I would say.
That's exactly what I told them. I said, "Listen, I know where you're coming from. You have seen how painful it is for people when a marriage falls apart. Maybe your parents or your friends' parents, maybe among some of your friends. You're so afraid of being hurt that you don't want to invest yourself fully in this marriage. Half of you goes into the relationship and half stands outside and evaluates whether it's worth continuing. But I'll tell you something," I said to them. "If you go into this marriage with a sense of, well, if it doesn't work out, we can always split, I know it's going to fail. It can't possibly. What happens is we have seen people so badly hurt by marriages that don't work that they are afraid to love. You see people looking for intimacy without commitment, looking for relationships without risk, no-fault marriages and no-fault divorce and no-fault parenthood, and I better not invest too much of myself in this because if it doesn't work out, it's going to hurt too much. We are so numbed by the spiritual Novocaine we've injected into ourselves to make sure that nothing hurts, that we feel no pain. But we also feel no love, no joy, no hope, no fear, no nothing. I'll tell you something. I believe a lot of middle-class people, relatively affluent people, get involved with drugs, drift into extramarital affairs, do dumb things that endanger their lives because it's the only time that they feel alive. I have had people come to me and talk about a pattern of one-night stands and extramarital affairs that they've gotten into. And the message I get is that they did not get into these things out of passion. They got into them out of boredom. They just needed something different and a little dangerous to make them feel alive because the rest of the time their life is so dull.
Well, I'm sure that's true. I think there's sometimes another motive mixed in, which is equally non-sexual or asexual or beyond sexuality. Pattern for adultery and that kind of very active adultery where life is a series of one-night stands. I think if someone will go to bed with you, especially perhaps for a man, if a woman will go to bed with you, maybe it works the other way as well, but if a woman will go to bed with you on short acquaintance and with little entreaty, minimal entreaty, that tells you that she regards you as something quite special. That is a way of confirming that you are attractive, that you are worthy, that you are important, that you are indeed somebody. Jesse Jackson is always telling his parishioners, you are, I am somebody. He asks them to repeat that. Well, one way to find out that I am somebody is to find that a lot of women will go for me while I barely exert myself to seduce them. And I wonder if that kind of reassurance of one's own worth isn't also involved.
I think so. Oh, yeah, I think that's a very large part of it. I'm thinking of a slightly different pattern. That is, people who really don't care, but it kind of makes life a little bit more interesting and a little spicier. But no, I think what you're saying, especially for the man and sometimes the woman who enters middle age, needs a whole lot of reassurance about his or her attractiveness. I mean, so much modern advertising is built on the unstated question, am I still sexually attractive? Mm-hmm. And so much of what we do, we really need that sort of reassurance. There's a wonderful true story that a friend of mine tells on himself. When he was, maybe 39 or 40, separated from his wife, living in a singles complex, set out for work one day, carefully blow-dried his hair, trimmed his mustache, unbuttoned his sport shirt so the medallion on his chest would show, sets out to go to work feeling...
And the dyed black hairs on his chest would show.
That's right. Feeling very virile and sexy, convinced he's going to spend all day apologizing to people that they've made a mistake and he's not Tom Selleck. Uh-huh. Gets on the bus to go to work. The bus is crowded. He has to stand. Seated right in front of him is this strikingly attractive college co-ed, woman going into this class with a bag of books on her lap. She is so stunning that my friend can't take his eyes off her. He's staring at her. At one point, she looks up, catches his glance. They look at each other for a while. My friend, not knowing where this might lead, but interested in finding out, tentatively smiles at her. The young woman smiles warmly back at him, stands up and offers him her seat.
I thought she was going to turn to him and say, oh, Mr. Cohen, don't you remember me? I'm Ruthie, your daughter so-and-so's friend.
Yes. But your daughter used to babysit for me.
Or your daughter used to babysit for me would be even better. Either way, it's a put-down, yeah.
Yes.
So what are people really after? They think they're after happiness, but that just, in a way, delays the question, because in your definition of happiness, you find what you're really after. And people don't all define happiness as being on the heights. They sometimes symbolize happiness with rather odd and surprising things.
I think people are after fulfillment. They're after the sense that they have made a difference. I could accept, for example, the psychological explanation that Lee Harvey Oswald shot President Kennedy in 1963 because he was an inconspicuous, frequently rejected, marginal man whom nobody took seriously. And this was his way of saying, I am somebody. I can make people notice me. I think these poor souls who show up on the evening news every now and then, that they've taken somebody hostage with a shotgun and the SWAT team has to go down and everything. Mm-hmm. I think what they're trying to say is...
We had one in Chicago just the other day. You know.
I'm sure it happens all the time. You never go a week.
Killed two people in the process.
That's right. What are these people doing? I mean, it's crazy. It's irrational. There is no rational connection between their problems and what they do. I think they're, at some level, they're trying to say, I will make the world notice me. This delight people have when their names appear in the papers, the way they mug on television cameras, it's a way of saying, I'm important enough that people will notice me. I had a funny experience.
Well, hold on, though. You don't really believe that that is what life is about, do you?
Of course not. That I believe that
you need to leave some influence upon the world as you've passed through it, which will persist after you've passed through. Do you think that's a justification of existence?
I think that's a big part of it. And I think a lot of people distort this need to have an impact, to leave footprints on the sand.
Couldn't
of time,
one live with
will?
Some contentedness in this life, feeling that in all likelihood one will have made no difference whatsoever, except that one has met one's obligations and one has been capable of some love and has been nurturant for some people of special value to you. Though that's making a difference.
You have just made a very significant exception, Milt. Yes, to say...
If you've lived all alone, then you've lived an unfulfilling life. But if you've lived with a few others and you've loved your spouse and your children and you've been good for or to them, all things in balance, you've been more good for them than bad for them, that's about as much difference as anyone is entitled to, it seems.
Right, and this is really what I'm saying. I'm telling people who come either to the middle or the last act of their lives and feel that because they weren't famous, they weren't rich, they never got to be president of the company, they never fulfilled the dream that they started out with, I'm saying to them, redefine success in exactly the terms that Milt Rosenberg just did.
And I guess
did.
You're also saying we do pursue many false gods or many false goals. We are caught up in a round of ambition and egocentric aspiration, which is intrinsically ruinous, though we don't learn that until the story's almost over.
That's what I'm saying, but I don't say it as well as you do.
Well, I want to hear how you say it, and I'm sure you say it as well as I do, and we should look at some of the false purposes that people pursue in life. And let's do that right after we pause to pursue these utterly valid purposes.
From WGN Radio Chicago, you're listening to Extension 720. Back now to your host, Milt Rosenberg.
Thank you, Floyd Brown. And back to our guest, Rabbi Harold Kushner, known to just about all the world as the author a few years ago of the book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, and his new book, When All You've Ever Wanted Isn't Enough, subtitled The Search for a Life That Matters. Will bring him equal attention and, I think, equal compliment from the critics and an equally large reading audience. When All You've Ever Wanted Isn't Enough is just published by Summit Books. I was asking you, before we pause for those commercials, what then are the false purposes that we pursue? What are the goals that we're after which aren't worth having, and though we only discover that after we've attained them?
With your permission, Milt, I would rephrase the question a little bit. It's not that they're false gods. There are some things we do which are appropriate in a very limited sense. I think, for example, of the striving to be number one, to be successful in the conventional terms, to prove that you're better than everybody else, that you can earn more money, you can do more.
I'm the greatest.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think young people ought to be competitive. Nothing would get done in the world if they weren't. You know the old Jewish story from the Talmud?
Yes.
About the, in that case, you tell it. The story about the day they catch the spirit of selfishness and trap it in a closet. And they say, from now on, our world will be paradise. Nobody will be selfish. The next morning, nobody opens a store. Nobody buys. Nobody sells. Nobody gets married. Nobody goes courting, because all these things have an element of selfishness in them.
Isn't that curious? That's what Adam Smith said 2,500 years later.
That's right.
The whole point of the Wealth of Nations is the competition of separate selfishnesses will, as if guided by an invisible hand, produce the greatest good for the greatest number.
I think they're saying something slightly different. They're saying that selfishness is perhaps a necessary, if not a necessary evil, at least a necessary admixture of evil with virtue, that it's a kind of a spice which, taken alone, is toxic and in small measures spices up life. That you can't have a world without a certain measure of selfishness. But I think young people have to be career-oriented, goal-oriented. Young people have to set out to find out how good they are. And there comes a point where you have to say, that's enough. Because being success-oriented, wanting to be number one, contains within itself the flaws of its own frustration. If you're good, you're going to end up so far ahead of other people that you're all alone, and who wants to live all
alone?
How
do you know when that's enough?
What
marks the outer boundary of enoughness?
A couple of things might. One is the escalator stops moving upward. You have to work harder and make less progress. It just reaches a point of diminishing returns. You find out, all right, this is how good I am, and I'm going to settle for it. Two is you get to that point in your life where almost inobtrusively you notice that you're looking at things differently. This is looking at myself. This is what I wrote the book about. All of a sudden I realized I wasn't asking the same questions. I was no longer asking, how far will I get? How high can I rise? How much can I achieve? I started asking, what will it all add up to? What will be left when I'm not here anymore? I think you start seeing time differently. There comes a day, it could be illness, it could be the death of a parent, the death of somebody your own age. There comes a day when you realize your own mortality, when you realize you're not going to be around forever. You see, Milt, young people can squander time. Young people can waste a year finding themselves. Young people can say, I'm going to take another year of college. Young people can get into dead-end jobs, dead-end relationships, go back to the starting line and start all over again, and all they've wasted is 6 months.
To the virgins to make much of time, you remember?
Sure.
Gather ye rosebuds while ye may, old time is still a-flying, and this same flower that blooms today, tomorrow will be dying.
I love to listen to you quote poetry.
But kids don't know that.
Kids shouldn't know it.
Yeah, it's relevant for their lives.
There is
early death, too.
Yeah, but that's the exception. There was a reporter from Reuters who was interviewing me the other day who said to me, what would you like to have known at 25 that you now know at 50? Uh-huh. And I said, nothing. I wouldn't want to change a thing. I think it's necessary for me to have made those mistakes, shortchanged my family, gotten all my priorities wrong, and learned from doing it myself. There is something uncomfortable, almost out of the twilight zone, about a prematurely wise 25-year-old.
Then wisdom would be a kind of vulgarity in the young.
It would be out of place, that's right.
Yeah.
It would be inappropriate, unseemly. I think young people have to make their mistakes and have to be goal-oriented. Nothing would get done in the world if they
A young didn't. Fool suits nature's rule, but an old fool is tragic.
Or Clemenceau, that anyone who's not a romantic at 20 has no heart, and anyone who's not a conservative at 50 has no head.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I think there is a time where you realize you have outgrown the perspective of youth, and you're looking at things very differently, and now you no longer want to strive to be successful. You don't want to be number one, because you see, in order to succeed, you have to see other people as rivals. You have to push them out of the way. And then you get to the point where, you know, that as long as we're swapping aphorisms here, the line I cite from Oscar Wilde, that there are two tragedies in life. One is to want something and not get it, and the other is to get it.
To get it, yeah.
When you've gotten where you dreamed of being, and you look around and you say to yourself, is this all there is? This is what I pushed people out of the way for? This is what I knocked myself out, worked weekends, took work home so I could be here? It's
you know,
not worth it.
There's another reason why you shouldn't go on wanting to be number one through all of your, one hopes, long and potentially successful life. And that is because you can't be number one. We are playing the game of quotations. Satchel Paige said, don't look back, somebody might be gaining on you. The fact is, somebody always is. And the young coming on are usually motivated to make their mark by knocking over their seniors. Harold Bloom at Yale, the great contemporary literary critic, has a great insight. What literature is really about is that the new guys coming on are trying to shoot down the masters who shaped them and whose work was of deepest influence to them. They're trying to exceed and even to alter the suppositions of the literary art and to exceed the achievements of the old master.
The sons toppling the fathers.
The son, it's the Oedipal theme.
Yes.
The sons are always coming on to kill the fathers one way or another. Therefore, if you try to hang on as number one through all of your conscious years, you are sooner or later going to recognize that you're being displaced by the young.
Let me give you what I think is an even more shocking example of this. Some years back, before one of the Olympic Games, Sports Illustrated did a survey of aspiring athletes at the Olympic tryout camps. They asked these...
They certainly get displaced by the younger sooner or later.
Yes, but they asked these world-class athletes, if you could surreptitiously take a drug which would enable you to set a world record at the Olympics and be dead 6 months later, would you do it?
Oh, my.
And 3 out of 5 said they would.
God.
Can you believe that?
That's shocking.
They are so desperate to leave their mark on time and then die and not be around. It's like the Hausman poem to an athlete dying young. Mm. Not be around to see the next generation of athletes and drug takers surpass their mark. Just to have been the best. They are willing to sell their souls to the devil.
Yeah.
To be the best for 1 hour, for 1 year. It's desperate. Now, some people will be number one, but what saddens me is that if you define success the way the baseball teams do, or the way, listen, I'm a Bostonian in Chicago, I'll talk about the Super Bowl. My football team from New England was embarrassed, chastened, humiliated, made a laughingstock because we were only the second best football team in the world last year, and they can't stand the humiliation. Defining success is coming in first.
Some of your guys were taking drugs, too, as a matter of fact.
Well, that's another discussion. I wonder what the spread would have been if they hadn't been. If you define success as coming in first, 99% of the people in the world are going to be losers. And who wants to think of himself as a loser?
Okay, we've established the point. One of the false goals, if you overdo it and if you stay with it too long, is the pursuit of excellence. That's the title of a recent book, isn't it? And that is part of America's creed, this year at least, the pursuit of excellence. What else do we do wrong?
I think one of the things we do is the opposite. The one of the ways we define success is not letting anything really get to us. We will master our environment. Taking Ecclesiastes as my model, he tells the story of his life. When he's very young, he becomes wealthy. And he looks around and says, wealth isn't it. Wealth disappears. Wealth, either you lose your money before you die. That's right. Either you lose it before you die or you lose it when you die.
Yeah.
He then turns to pleasure, goes to a lot of parties, has a lot of fun. And he can't find meaning in fun either. I think one of the problems that keeps us from being happy is we are really ambivalent about pleasure. There is a part of us that says to us, you don't deserve to have it so good. The example I like to give is the person eating a hot fudge sundae. And as you lift the spoonful of ice cream with hot fudge sauce to your mouth, you're saying to yourself, I shouldn't be doing this. This is wrong. Why am I so weak? I know this is terrible. And then you eat it and it tastes good, so you go back for more. This sense that our mind is nagging our body, the sense that there's a civil war within our souls, half of us saying to the other half, you weakling, you pervert, you sensualist, and the other half responding, you prude, you rejecter of the world's pleasures. How can you ever be happy if you're always fighting with yourself, if you're ashamed of yourself?
So from that follows what prescription about wise living?
The prescription I like is a sense of moderation. There's that line I quote from the Talmud that in the world to come, everybody will be held responsible for the pleasures God put in this earth that he refused to take part in.
Uh-huh.
There is a sense that life is meant to be enjoyed but not wallowed in. There is a sense that there should not be a split of mind and body. The sense of your conscience being external to the other you and constantly nagging you. Nobody likes to be nagged by that. If we could somehow reconcile the two, if we could stop nagging ourselves and stop putting ourselves down and stop criticizing ourselves.
Now let me offer you another cause for despair. Again, I think I'll time it so that I'll give it to you and then we pause for some commercials and then get your
That'll give me a chance to think up an answer.
This cause for despair was discovered on the afternoon of June 27th, 1946, at a table at the Café Audemago in Paris, right there at on the Boulevard Saint-Mich. It was discovered by the existentialists. The despair is, or the basis for the despair is, there is no meaning, there is no purpose. We are a cosmic accident. We have been through evolution or some process or other. Biology isn't my business, philosophy is, said Jean-Paul Sartre, or said his friend Simone de Beauvoir. By some process or other, we were given consciousness and a sense of purpose. But in this latter day, and after this dreadful war we've come through and long disabused of the illusions of religion with which we were raised, they were raised as Catholics, others are raised as Jews or whatever, we learn that we are a cosmic accident. God doesn't exist, or if he did once exist, he's dead, or if he's not dead, he's not interested. He's looking elsewhere, he's busy elsewhere in the universe. All the purposes that we've pursued to save mankind, to bring social justice, to unfold universal truth, all of these are illusions. This is the ultimate vision of Ecclesiastes. These are the ultimate vanities. We think we can somehow connect to the infinite and find meaning and purpose which gives the ultimate fulfillment to our lives. Not mere love, not mere philoprogenitiveness, taking care of children or whatever, or being nice to our old parents, but to really approach truth, approach justice, and to move mankind in that direction, there is purpose. We used to think that was true. None of it is true. There is no purpose. There is no good. There is no bad. Time just flows on, and we are accidentally here. That is the terrible burden of mankind.
Is there any meaning to life? Milton Rosenberg fans, stay tuned for the answer.
That's the question. Is there then any meaning to life? We know that the answer the existentialists came up with is, we can give that away right now, no, there is no meaning, which paradoxically gives us the meaning that we must be brave in the face of meaninglessness, and that is a kind of meaning. That may have satisfied Jean-Paul and Simone.
Especially if they were a little drunk.
Especially if they were drinking absinthe on the corner in Paris. It doesn't satisfy me, and I think it doesn't satisfy you.
Correct.
Where in the world do you find meaning beyond the verities of familial obligation and things of that sort?
We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with the answer after these words.
You're listening to Extension 720 on WGN Radio Chicago. Back now to your host, Milt Rosenberg.
Thank you, Floyd. Our guest tonight, Rabbi Harold Kushner. We are drawing from, but by no means plumbing, the full riches of his new book, When All You've Ever Wanted Isn't Enough, that book just published by Summit. Is Summit still a division of New York Times books?
No, it's Simon & Schuster.
Oh, it's Simon & Schuster.
Right.
It may never have been New York Times. I don't know why I had that idea.
It's supposed to be Simon & Schuster's prestige imprint.
Of course.
At least that's what they tell me. Now, you were asking me a very important question just before the commercial break. What was it?
You can rephrase it for me.
Oh, there's Jean-Paul Sartre and the existentialist saying, what is the significance of life?
There's no meaning. Man is an accident.
Yeah.
He may get some domestic pleasures, or he may get the fleeting pleasures of fame, but nothing he does really matters because we are trivial in the universe.
Which is essentially what Ecclesiastes is saying.
Quite so.
A friend of mine, responding to my last book about how you cope with suffering, said, the question is an irrelevant question because I was asking it only from a human point of view. And my friend said, if frogs could write theology, they would ask, why doesn't a God of love make more mosquitoes in the world for us to eat?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, you've exactly missed the point. The point is...
And why doesn't he punish those who eat frog legs?
That's right. Well, my Orthodox friends would say he does. But that's another discussion.
<be sure. laughs>
I said to my friend, you're missing the point. The point is, human beings ask, why does God let these things happen? Human beings write theology, and frogs don't. And that's why the death of a child is a tragedy, and the death of a tadpole isn't. Ecclesiastes, as I understand him, and it's a hard book to pin down, what I catch him saying at the end is something like this. He's saying, I asked myself, is there anything significant about human life? And I didn't find any answer. I didn't find anything significant about it. But then I realized that the question itself is its own answer. The fact that I am moved to ask, what is significant about my life? The fact that I am desperately yearning for meaning, for a sense of importance, identifies me as different from all other living creatures. What makes human beings special is that we are the only creatures who ask, what is the significance of our lives? And even if we can't answer it, just asking the question is an answer.
But what if the answer comes back, not in thunder from God, because God isn't there? What if the answer that really comes back to you is there? The answer to what is the meaning in life is, there isn't any. There is no meaning.
But what Ecclesiastes says...
That's the great modern burden.
Yes,
that's
I
what
know.
Drives moderns crazy.
But that's, I think that's an inadequate answer. Ecclesiastes says it doesn't matter what the answer is. The question itself is proof of significance.
Why? How?
Because we're the only creature that asks it. And this itself is significant.
Then one could respond. I'm being contentious on this now.
I appreciate that.
Then... the possible response is, therefore, we are the blighted. We are the most fully injured. We are the most unfortunate of all creatures because we are the ones who've got the intelligence to ask the question. Thus, the answer that there is no meaning comes to us and comes to no other. A lion doesn't raise the question. His life doesn't have meaning. It doesn't lack meaning. It simply has isness. He is a lion. a man seeks meaning when he fails to find it, then he is defeated as a man.
No, he doesn't have to be defeated. Ecclesiastes finds himself in precisely that corner. And his answer is, if logic tells me that there is no meaning to life, I'm not going to give up on life, I'm going to give up on logic. I'm going to listen to that yearning in my soul that says a human being has to be more than a tadpole, has to be more than a mayfly, and that yearning itself is its own justification. To me, what God represents is the source of our feeling. What God does for us is that he takes us seriously as moral agents. All those laws that you and I were kidding around about before we went on the air, the things Jews aren't supposed to eat and the things that pious people aren't supposed to do, they're not there to deprive us of fun, and they're not there to restrict us or to punish us. They're there to make us take ourselves seriously as moral agents, that human beings have a sense of morality about their sexual behavior, and dogs don't, that human beings have a sense of reverence for life, and lions mm-hmm. don't, that human beings have a sense of respect for property, and monkeys and blue jays don't.
Now then.
This makes us moral agents. God takes us seriously, and by doing that, by making demands on us, he invests our lives with significance.
It is not a great surprise to find that a common term in your operative vocabulary is God. But, Rabbi, you should excuse me. Ihr sollt mir entschuldigen. I have friends who don't believe in God. I have friends who literally consider themselves not merely secular humanists, but the leaders of the American Humanist Association. Paul Kurtz is one of those friends. He's been on this program a few times. He's a professor of philosophy. There are, as you well, indeed, as one goes up the scale of education, one finds a diminution in theistic commitment. And
Milt,
soon you find a fair amount of atheism. Could you have this whole conversation without reference to God? Is it indeed possible to conceive a meaningful existence accepting the burdens and the intrinsic dignity of manhood or of humanness if one doesn't at the same time assume the presence of a God looking on and caring?
Milt, I have good news for your secular humanist friends.
Yeah.
God's grace is such that he even takes atheists seriously as moral agents.
But consider it.
Are you asking me, can I have a conversation with these people in terms of their vocabulary rather than mine?
Yes,
I probably could.
You could.
Yeah, but
what would substitute for the term God?
Well, what we'd be doing is an old debater's trick called conversion by definition. That is, we'd be using dissimilar terms to cover pretty much the same thing. I would talk to your humanist friends, your atheist friends, about self-fulfillment, about Menschlichkeit, the challenge to be a mensch,
mm-hmm.
about that. What I would say to them is basically what I say in religious terms in my book, that just as our bodies are made so that certain kinds of food and certain kinds of lifestyle are healthier than others, and if you try and fool Mother Nature by drinking too much, by overeating, you can get away with it for a couple of years, but it catches up to you, I'm persuaded that our souls are made in such a way that certain kinds of behavior are healthier than others. I think it's really spiritually toxic to be selfish, to be cynical, to tell lies, to be jealous of other people. And I think we've all had this experience. You literally feel better, physically better, when you have gone out of your way to do a favor for somebody. I think I see this in theistic terms, but I'm not going to insist on it. What I will argue with your atheist friends about is not whether God gets the credit. I would argue about the moral seriousness of how one lives one's life.
We come then to something like the moment for the Decalogue, a modern Decalogue. Maybe you still, I'm sure you would still have to assert all of the Ten Commandments. Maybe you want to add a few and make them 15 commandments. I look for the ultimate practical translation. How then should a man live? What are the rules of life that follow from all you've said and from the fuller explication of these themes as you give it in your new book?
Well, I wouldn't count them, but let me just summarize a few that come to mind. I think the key to being a mensch, to being a fully realized human being, is first to share your life with other people, and with the same people, with a sense of commitment, with a sense of seriousness, with a sense that they can depend on you and you can depend on them, that you'll be there for
love
each other.
Love is real, love should last, love has its obligations.
That's right, more than that. I quote the anthropologist Leakey, who went to Africa to study chimpanzees, and he has this wonderful aphorism that one chimpanzee is no chimpanzee. That is, a chimp expresses its chimphood only in a community. Human beings are like that. You can't be human in isolation. This tradition of the saint who turns his back on the world because the world is so full of sin and so flawed. Totally, totally wrong. That's not a saint. I mean, Mother Teresa is a saint because she goes down and works for the sick people.
In this, you're very Jewish, of course. There is no asceticism in the Judaic tradition. There is in the Christian tradition.
Right. More than that, in our Jewish tradition, holiness is only found among people.
Life is with people.
Not found in isolation. The Buber idea that God fills the space and connects people to each other so they're not apart. That's rule number one. Life has to be shared in a very serious way with people. I had the opportunity of giving up my congregational life and becoming a full-time writer and lecturer. Would have made a lot more money with a lot less effort, and I chose not to do it because I need to belong to people.
You are still the leader of the congregation at Temple Israel in Natick, Massachusetts?
That's right. I'm half-time, which gives me the opportunity to be here talking to you and your audience tonight, but I'm still very much a congregational rabbi. Rule number two, for the fully realized human life, take off the armor that you wear because you're afraid that life will hurt. Be willing to risk pain. Be willing to risk failure and frustration. Finding out that some things hurt is not a whole lot of fun, but it's at least this. It's the proof that you're alive, because if you weren't alive, it wouldn't hurt. Rule number three, I cite Eric Erickson, who said, human beings have a need to teach. One of the things you need to do, especially as you get into the second and third act of your life, is to share what you have learned with other people. It is not entirely a coincidence that when I was in my mid-40s, I cut back on giving sermons and started writing books so that my ideas would have a more permanent form and a wider audience. It's not a coincidence that at 48, I arranged to bring in a younger associate rabbi in my congregation so I could be a mentor to him, as I had a mentor when I was a brand new rabbi starting out. So there's someone to whom I could pass on the perceptions, the experiences, the tricks of the trade
that
I have learned.
I like that story about, or there, at least there's a slogan, having to do with how you respond to favors received, things help you've got along the way, and the way you, or what you do when you give an important favor to somebody, which helps them along the way. He says, how can I ever repay you? The answer is, you don't repay me, pass it on. And that's what you're talking about.
You know the story, Dev? I'm going to tell you that where I first heard that.
Do
you know the book, The Memoirs of Glickel of Hameln? A medieval Jewish woman at a time where women never did anything public.
I have not read it, but I know of its existence.
It's a classic.
Reference to it.
She writes the story of her life, her marriage, her widowhood. She tells the fable there about the mother bird leading her baby birds along a way, and they come to a big puddle. And the water is too deep for the baby birds to get across. And so the mother bird turns to the first chick and says, if I carry you on my back, how will you repay me? And the baby bird says, at the next puddle, I'll carry you on my back. Mm-hmm. Mother says, that's silly. Right? You can't cross by yourself. How can you carry me on your back? Says to the second baby bird, if I carry you across on my back, how will you repay me? And the baby bird says, when I grow up to be your age, I'll carry you on my back. Mother says, no. When you get to be my age, I'll be dead. Turns to the third one and says, if I carry you across the water on my back, how will you repay me? And the baby bird says, when I'm a mother bird, I'll carry my babies across in the same way. And I think that's what we're really talking about.
Very nice. We've got three rules for good living. You got any more?
I'm ready
for four or five.
Now, let's stop with those three right now.
What do you do with I mentioned the Ten Commandments. What do you do with them? Are they rules of a different order, or are they?
Oh, they're rules of a different order.
They're prohibitions in the main.
Well, yes, but certainly I take them seriously. But I'm not overly awed by them, because for me, the Ten Commandments are a recipe for staying out of jail.
Yeah.
And I think there is more to humanity and more to goodness than simply staying out of jail. There is a Talmudic term, naval b'rishut ha-Torah, a scoundrel with the Bible's permission. It refers to a person who is an absolute louse without ever breaking one of the commandments. There are all sorts of things that you can manage to do that the Bible never got around to prohibiting, that its imagination didn't extend.
Now, look, since I'm making trouble for you in a friendly way tonight, let me come at you from the other end.
Sure.
Let me come at you from the vantage point of somebody concerned with the world's large affairs and with the implicit tragedy of impending war and the continuing tragedy of social injustice and repression of men by other men and so on, and say to you, all of this sounds fine for making a good, sort of morally fulfilling middle-class life in a safe American city or suburban city 20 or 50 miles from Boston, but how does it connect you back to what the world needs of you as a privileged person. What are you doing for mankind if you are simply meeting these obligations of commitment and philoprogenitiveness and generativity and taking care of your own family and maybe being of some use and some benefit to others in your own immediate community? Doesn't that isolate you from the large themes of the requirements of mankind in a very difficult time in its history?
At one level, yes. That is, the great decisions will not be made by people like you and me. They'll be made by the people we elect. But at a very important level, I think I'm doing two things. First, in a negative way, and you know, like the Sherlock Holmes story of I call your attention to what the dog did last night. Well, the dog didn't do anything, precisely. What doesn't happen can be as important as what happens. The kind of redefinition of purposefulness, of success, of fulfillment that I'm advocating, at the very least, will keep people from doing some of the rotten, destructive things which have polluted the moral air for so long. And I think that's an important contribution to making the world better. Secondly, in a democracy, angry, non-impulsive American population, and I think that'll do a great deal to make the world a better place.
Somehow you remind me of Jimmy Carter when he was first running for the presidency, saying his aspiration is to make a government that's as good as the people who elect it.
I think one of the tenets of democracy is we get the government we deserve, God help us. And when we deserve a better government, when we become a people who are not angry, who are not petty, who are not selfish, then I think American social and international policy will reflect that.
Listen, we got to stop in a moment for some commercials and then on to the phones. And that reminds me, I should instantly invite telephone callers. Anybody who wants to put a question to Rabbi Harold Kushner or share a thought is by all means invited to give us a call instantly. The number 591-7200. 591-7200, the area code 312 for long-distance calls, and we always try to give long-distance calls priority. The lines are open. We await your calls and look forward to hearing from you. But that reminds me of one thing I wanted to get onto before we pause for commercials and then onto the phones. Is there anything distinctively Jewish about all that you've been saying?
At one level, Milt, I think there is no Jewish truth about the meaning of life any more than there is Jewish algebra. No, I think if it's valid, it's valid for human beings. At another level, I think, just as there was in my previous book, there are matters of emphasis which flow from the fact that I am a traditional rabbi. Chief among them, I think, is my insistence on taking this world seriously. I have to find meaning in my life in this world. If I don't find this life meaningful, I cannot say, well, there must be another world beyond this, and that's where everything works out. I have to believe, as a Jew, that God so loved this world that he lavished a lot of loving care on making it so beautiful and so complex and so intricate, and that I have to take the world as seriously as he did. I have to take my life seriously in this world, and I have to do what I can to make it meaningful. I think that's a Jewish emphasis.
Let's pause, take care of some commercials, and then right on to the phones. 591-7200 is the number. A number of lines are available at this moment, but if you begin to hit a busy signal, then remember you can always try again right after we've said goodnight to some prior caller. 591-7200.
From WGN Radio in Chicago, you're listening to Extension 720. Back now to your host, Milt Rosenberg.
Thank you, Floyd, and we return to Rabbi Harold Kushner of Temple Israel in Natick, Massachusetts, who occasionally pauses to write a provocative and, in some ways, consoling book. One of them was When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And that they've done everything with that except make it into a movie. For all I know, they've made it into a movie.
They offered us to make it a movie.
Did they really?
You thought you were kidding, but
yes, I did.
We were approached by a production company that wanted to make one of these Monday night made-for-television sickness of the week movies.
Good heavens.
It turned out that they didn't want to make it about my theology. They wanted to make it about the personal story of our family.
The story about your son.
A domestic soap opera about a rabbi whose son has this incurable disease, who's dying at home while he's out solving everybody else's problems. We said, no thanks.
Well, it was, of course, appropriately dignified for you to reject that, I would say.
Well, I told them my ideas are for sale. My life is not for sale.
The new book, When All You've Ever Wanted Isn't Enough, is just published by Summit Books. 591-7200 is the number, and let's get on to the phones. Good evening, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening. Your program touches me very deeply tonight, and that's why I'm calling. I'm 40 years old and lost my father in December of 1984 and went through a lot of changes at that time. And I came at that time to my own definition of what the meaning of life is. And 2 days after my father died, I sat down and wrote a letter to a friend about him and ended it with a paragraph that I'd like to share with you, which basically says what I think will give meaning to my life. I had just described to him in the letter how my father had suffered a great deal before he died, and then this is my last paragraph. And so I am left with these almost contradictory feelings. I am relieved that he is no longer suffering and sad to see him go. Not much of a choice, is it, suffer or go? I don't ask why anymore. There are no answers to that question. We're here, and we have to live in such a way as not to die with regrets. To know that we never reached out to hurt anyone, although we may inadvertently or in anger do so. To have done the best we could do in whatever we chose to do. And to have meaningfully touched some people in our lives, left a part of ourselves behind. Some thoughts of a 40-year-old.
I think that's beautiful, and I can really respond to that at many, many levels. I think you've handled it perfectly. One of the things I hear the book of Ecclesiastes saying, when he has to confront the prospect of his own death and disappearance, is that there's a sense in which things which don't last forever really do endure. The fact that you can summon up the memory of who your father was means that while in one sense he died, in another sense he is still a very living presence. The fact that any one of us can close our eyes and remember a moment that happened 20 or 30 years ago because it was so important for us means that something which lasted for only 5 minutes has lasted for 20 years. I think that's the way we defeat death. I'm not trying to deny it. I'm not trying to say that it's as if your father was still there, because it's not. There is all the difference in the world between having a father and having a memory of a father. But at the same time, the ultimate refutation of the fear of death is that your father, my father, my son, lived in such a way that we are permanently changed for having known them, and that a lot of other people are permanently changed for having known them. And that even when the last person who knew your father in life will die, the world will somehow still be feeling the ripple effects of the kind of person he was. And I think you've said that very eloquently.
Thank you. Mr. Rosenberg, if I could say just one more thing.
Sure.
You asked a question as to whether knowing the meaning of life or being able to have meaning in your life somehow is connected with a belief in God.
Uh-huh.
I'd just like to mention to you that I am what most people call an atheist. I don't call myself an atheist. And somehow I have found that meaning. So I don't think that it's a necessity.
You know, I have a friend, Rabbi Harold Schulweis in Encino, California, who says that when you have statements like God is truth, God is courage, God is love, the atheist is not the person who denies the subject in the sentence. The atheist is the guy who denies the predicate. I don't care if somebody says they believe in God or not. The question is, do they believe in the things that I believe God stands for and makes possible? I would insist, and this is the game called conversion by definition. I will, you know, if an atheist is a nice person, I will prove to them they're not really an atheist, that they believe in the same God I do, they just don't realize it. I would say the person who denies God but affirms generosity and unselfishness and honesty and courage and love, in my vocabulary, is not an atheist. I don't care who they give the credit to.
So good to exchange this with you. Mr. Rosenberg, you had Malachi Martin on your show several times.
Yes.
And one time when he was on, he gave his definition of God. And I plagiarized from his definition a little bit. I changed it a little bit.
Uh-huh.
He said that God is that one thing in life that gives meaning to life.
Uh-huh.
And I changed that, and I say God is that one thing in life that gives you the strength to keep living. And I happen to find that strength within myself, and I have no need to personify it or to say that it belongs to something outside of me or supernatural. I'm not uncomfortable with knowing that that strength is within me. So in a sense, I believe in the same God that everyone else does.
Sure. I think the last thing we need to do tonight, ma'am, is to quibble about how that strength got inside you. It doesn't really matter.
Yes.
You've got it, and we're both grateful.
Yes. Ma'am, we thank you for the call.
You're welcome.
591-7200, the number. Back to the phones in an instant. What a curious thing it is, and I wonder how one accounts for it, that in all of the broad range of creation or evolution, and words are trivial, they do that for one another, but of all the creatures that live, the millions of species, one cannot really imagine that there is any other species, including our nearest relatives, the high anthropoid apes, who concern themselves with matters of the sort that we're talking about now.
That's right. That's the image of God that only human beings have, the sense of self-consciousness. Teilhard de Chardin, for example, about evolution is in the direction of self-consciousness, of being aware of who you are and what is happening around you. Or the line I like, since you and I love to sit here and swap aphorisms with each other, Conrad Lorenz in On Aggression, saying that scientists have discovered the missing link between apes and human beings. It's us.
Yeah, that's a good line coming from a former Nazi colonel. But then he got the Nobel Prize for other purposes. I have a rich set of thoughts there that would just distract us, I think. 591-7200. You didn't know that he was
a
Nazi officer. Maybe not a colonel, maybe only a captain. And indeed, as a medical man, I think. But all the same, I've always thought that Lorenz's stuff on aggression and his view of the inevitability of human aggression is in some sense a justification of the...
An apology.
Of the peace leaders of the Nazis. Yeah. 591-7200, and here's the next caller. Good evening, you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. Question to the rabbi. As he talks this evening about morality, and you gentlemen just were talking about government and how government should reflect the people, I was wondering, how does he feel that as we talk about morality on a grand scale, does he think that some things have to start on a smaller scale, that by instead of throwing a trash wrapper down in the street, we put it in our back pocket and throw it in the garbage can later, or help an old lady across the street, and somehow we can start ourselves on a grand... Because a lot of people during the day, they're too preoccupied with other things to think about the larger issues of life that you talk about, but if we can start concentrating on some of the smaller things of life, that it can help.
Oh, sure. My religious background, that is, as a traditional Jew, says that you bring holiness into your life not by one or two absolutely marvelous self-sacrificing deeds, but by thousands and thousands of little ones. I'm not sure that the first examples that would come to my mind would be the same ones that come to yours, but I think the principle you've established is an entirely valid one. Very few of us will have the opportunity to do something grand, to rescue somebody's life from in front of a murderer or a speeding car. Every one of us will have the opportunity to do kind, thoughtful things on a small scale. In the same way that you can't solve the problem of becoming human, let me put it this way, you can't solve the problem of becoming human with one great deed any more than you can solve the problem of eating with one grand meal. I mean, it's foolish to say, I will have a meal so wonderful that I'll never be hungry again. And it's equally impractical to say, I will do one deed so splendid that I will have achieved my humanity in a brief hour. Now, it's got to be made up of little deeds, because little deeds are what our lives are made up of, and I agree with you totally on that, sir.
Well, I do know I've participated in a few marches and demonstrations, but the biggest satisfaction I think I've ever got was helping an old lady change a flat tire. That's never made me feel any better.
Good for you. I agree with that.
I just wanted to pass that on. Thank you, gentlemen.
That's nice. Thank you for the call, sir. What then should I do when I go to the cleaners to pick up a suit and I find that somehow somebody's burned a hole in it, and the dumb, sort of mean guy, I've known him to be dumb and mean for the 10 years I've dealt with him, as he is occasionally behind the counter, informs me that hole was there before and it is not our responsibility. And if you read that sign up there, it tells you that we're not responsible for the damage that you do to your clothing or something of the sort. And I know that I'm being had. The suit is about half a year old and has always been well taken care of, and I've just had something destroyed. And furthermore, I'm treated with indifference, or even worse, with impoliteness, if not downright nastiness. What am I to do with the rage that I feel at that moment?
I feel like I've just stumbled into the people's court. If you're asking what you do with anger, and if you're asking what you do with rude people...
Legitimate anger.
Yes,
legitimate
absolutely.
Rage.
Well, there's not a whole lot you can do with legitimate rage. There's not a whole lot you can do with anger of any kind, and it's always there because these insults, these injuries to our psyche are happening all the time. The way people drive and the way people talk to each other and all sorts of little things, and you become frustrated. What do you do with anger? Well, one thing you do with anger is you hold it in until you become depressed because you've turned it on yourself, and you become frustrated, and you feel inadequate, and you become apologetic, and I think that's wrong. One thing you do with anger is you just go around permanently angry and dumping the rudeness that you received onto the next innocent victim. And I don't like that either. The word that's become commonplace recently is assertiveness, which is not being aggressive.
Uh-huh.
That is, you don't curse the guy out, you don't throw a rock through his window, and you don't go home and yell at your kids. You get it off your chest talking to him. You take your business elsewhere. I don't know what legal recourse you might have to get the price of the suit back, but you stop doing business with the guy. It's, by the way, my own experience has been that, yeah, there are clods in the world, but 90% of the incompetent business people that I have dealt with tend to be very apologetic and believe that the customer is always right. I had this experience, was it only yesterday that I was in Philadelphia? Yes, I went into a fast food place for lunch in between some media appointments I had, and I asked for a certain dish, and they brought me another one, which, because I'm an observant Jew, I could not eat.
Uh-huh.
And the waiter insisted that was what I had ordered, and I said, listen, I know I do not order this. And the manager came over, was terribly apologetic, and without question gave me my money back and apologized and gave me the dish free and so on. Most business people, unless they have a dumb self-destructive streak in them, will rather keep your business than save the money on the suit. But aside from that, what do you do with the anger? You get it out, asserting yourself in the presence of the person who's being rude to you, and if he's unresponsive, you get your anger out through physical exercise, through telling the story to somebody else, making it very clear that you're angry at the cleaner and not angry at them,
uh-huh.
no matter what tone of voice you may be telling the story in. But you don't keep the anger inside. You know, I'll tell you something. There are passages in the Bible in which God is described as angry. God is described as virtually zapping people, even with people.
He is, among other things, a God of wrath.
Sure. And what that says to me is that there are times where anger is the appropriate response. There are times where it is divinely appropriate to get angry, even as God does. This turning the other cheek is not really part of my ethic.
And what do you do with the nudnikim of the world? I've made a plural out of nudnik, which is hard to translate, but what does it mean? A bore, a fool.
Intrusive fool.
An intrusive fool who presumes to waste your time. Do you suffer fools gladly?
That's a hard question for me to answer, Milt. You see, I do because I get paid for it.
Yeah.
So
do I. I'm a college professor.
Yes.
Most of them are not fools, but there is.
I didn't think you were referring to your call-in audience, because when I have met them, and this is the second occasion, they've been a real class.
Nor am I necessarily referring to my students, but I do have colleagues as well.
Yes. One of the things I do, and let me phrase this as delicately as I can. Whenever I can, I try and suffer fools gladly, though it does not come easily to me, because I believe, at a level that I can't always translate into action, that every human being is God's child and is owed a modicum of respect just on that basis alone. He doesn't have to earn my respect. He earns it just like by being mm-hmm. a human being. I can't always live up to that. There are people I find tedious. There are people whom I instruct my secretary not to put their calls through. There are people I invent other engagements so I can detach myself from their company.
Rabbi, you lie?
I guess you would call it that, yes. I don't advertise it. I guess I just did uh-huh. to the millions of people listening to Rosenberg. Yeah, there are times where I can't be as noble as I would like to think of myself as being. I'm only 50, and I have to leave myself some room to grow and improve.
If Noah could lie to God, you can lie occasionally, too.
Where does Noah lie to God? I'm not challenging you. I'm asking to be taught by you.
When he asks God whether he can... what does he want to take along by way of hard liquor on the journey? Or by way of wine?
That's not in the Bible. I think that you may be thinking
apocryphal.
Of The Green Pastures by Mark Connolly.
Merely that?
It's not in Scripture.
Quite possibly. I'm sure you're right.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're right. Does anybody of worth lie in the Bible? Do anybody
God
else?
Does.
When and where?
That's of worth. Let's see. Where is it? It's the story of Abraham and Sarah when they're about to have a child.
Uh-huh.
It's a wonderful passage, and I've preached on this. You remember Abraham is 99 years old,
yeah.
and Sarah is 90, and they've given up on ever having kids. And God sends a messenger to tell them that a year from now they will have a child. Sarah hears the news and she laughs and says, how can I have a child? I'm married to an old man.
Uh-huh.
And God says to Abraham, when you have this child, you will call him Yitzchak, the one who causes laughter. Because when Sarah heard, she laughed and said, how can I have a child when I'm so old? That is, he misquotes Sarah. Uh-huh. Instead of saying, when my husband is so old, she says, when I'm old. And the rabbis in the Talmud say, in order to bring peace between husband and wife, even God is prepared to lie. There are times where telling the truth is not such a noble
thing.
Well,
of course, that's the case.
Where it's cruel to tell the truth.
Yeah, there's great wisdom in that.
Yeah.
So if God can do it, certainly you're entitled occasionally.
I feel better already.
And we've got to pause for some commercials, then directly back to the phones.
You're listening to Extension 720 on WGN Radio Chicago. Now again, your host, Milt Rosenberg.
Thank you very much, and we return to Harold Kushner as we draw from his new book, When All You've Ever Wanted Isn't Enough. 591-7200, you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
I was listening earlier to your discussion of existentialism and how they came to the understanding of God is dead because of the inhumanity of humankind to themselves. I've always understood that in creation, God limited the powers of God in giving humankind free will, and therefore humankind has the freedom to destroy itself or to love itself. And I'm wondering if the rabbi would respond to that.
Yes, that's exactly what I believe. I sometimes try to explain it this way, that maybe God could have created a perfect world where everybody would always do the right thing. No war, no crime, no theft, no rape, no murder. But maybe possibly God loves goodness more than he loves perfection. There's something a little bit static about being perfect. It's not interesting. It has no moral value. If we had to do the right thing all the time, it wouldn't be a moral choice. And so maybe because God cherishes goodness so much, at tremendous risk to his creation and to his creatures, he put human beings on a world capable of doing good or doing evil, and knowing that sometimes they would choose to do evil. And I have to believe it saddens him as much as it saddens us that sometimes we choose evil.
So then the pathway by which the existentialist comes to an understanding that God is dead is in reality the pathway that you come to a knowledge of God.
That's exactly right. That only as moral beings, free to choose good and evil, can we relate to God. The only kind of God who can relate to human beings is a God who limits his own power so that we can make a moral choice. The Talmud says at one point, when a person chooses to do something good and he didn't have to, God looks down and says, for that moment alone, it was worth creating the world.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sir, thank you for the call. 591-7200, good evening, you're on the air.
Yes, the rabbi said that God is a God of wrath at times, and I want to know, what does God do with his anger?
That's interesting. I really don't know. You know, we're caught up in this linguistic trap of talking about God as if he were a person. And I have to remind myself, and I guess I have to remind us all, that I don't think God really is a person. God is something other than you and me, but I don't have any words to talk about him except the words we use for talking about people.
Oh, but this is important. He's not a person. He's not a bubble. What is he?
I don't know.
What is it?
I don't know what God is. He's God. Maimonides, 850 years ago, said that we can only speak about God metaphorically. That is, we can say God is whatever we say about him, but words which we also use about ourselves and our world are only metaphorical. We use them about God.
He doesn't have extension, doesn't have corporeality.
Right. No body.
No body.
Right.
Is pervasive. Eternal.
There is a
before before time and beyond time.
Well, certainly beyond time. There's a school of thought called process theology, which tries to say, you're nodding as if you understood it. Nobody understands it. Nobody understands Alfred North Whitehead.
Well,
what they say
and
is...
Nobody has ever comprehended the book, Process and Reality, but many people have tried.
That's right.
I'm one of them.
God is not an object. God is a process. The fact that God is so often symbolized by a fire. Fire is not an object. Fire is the process of liberating the energy which is found in a lump of coal or a log of wood. And maybe God is a little bit like that. Maybe God is that which liberates the potential for goodness within every one of us, the potential for orderliness and beauty in the world. It's awkward, and I'm groping, but that's the best I can do. I really don't want to define God. You know, there's something terribly chutzpah, Dick. There's something very arrogant about us flawed human beings late on a Thursday night sitting around and deciding what God is.
You talk of chutzpah, Dick, or of chutzpah. Instead of using the Greek, why don't you use the Yiddish and call it hubris? Ma'am, we thank you for the call.
Okay, thank you.
And on to another. Here is that other. Good evening, you're on the air.
Good evening. I'd like to ask the rabbi to explain the significance of the Passover and why the Lord chose that particular vehicle for liberating the people of Israel from Egypt. And then I'd like to offer for comparison purposes my understanding from a Christian perspective.
Well, since you've already said that God is not personified and that the God we have in the Bible is obviously a poetic approximation or a convenient anthropomorphization of a process that we can barely conceive.
You say it so well, Milt.
That it would follow then that, I wonder what then does follow when you come to the great stories of Judaism like Passover.
Well, you take them as poems. And you know, the first rule of a poem is you don't understand it literally. You understand it poetically, metaphorically, suggestively, sort of right hemisphere rather than left hemisphere. Sir, I guess I read the story backwards. It's not that God chose this vehicle to free the people. It's that the people who were slaves became free through God's action, and they went back and wrote the story of how they thought it happened. If you're talking about smearing the blood of the lamb on the doorpost, for me, that's the least significant detail of the story. That's really the small stuff. The great stuff is that God cannot tolerate the idea that some of his creatures would own other of his human being creatures, and that God demands that all people live as free men. Beyond that, the other stuff is just detail.
Well, as a Christian, on my perspective, as you've indicated, you know, is exactly the opposite. That the crucial part of that story is the smearing of the blood of the lamb on the door, and the fact that the Lord chose to turn his wrath from those whose doors were covered with the blood of the innocent lamb. And of course, as a Christian, I see that as analogous as a story of a much more significant event to come later, when the blood of Jesus Christ, the innocent lamb, would save those who washed themselves in it from the wrath of God. And I think that's why the Lord chose that vehicle.
Well, I think there's no question that the story of the crucifixion is kind of a midrash on the Passover story, which, of course, the writers of the gospel knew very well. I think neither of us has the right to be so presumptuous as to try and read God's mind and figure out what he was thinking when he did whatever he may have done.
What, though, should Jews who are loyal Jews, but who recognize the provisionalism of all religions and the fact that all religions, in some sense, approach comparable truths, and not only the Western religions of the three peoples of the book, but the connections between what we aspire to and what the great Eastern religions, Buddhism and Hinduism, and aspire to. What then should such a Jew make of Christ the man, and Christ the figure of high spiritual consequence?
I think, first of all, as a Jew, I would have to distinguish.
I should have said Jesus the man rather than Christ the man, because that Christ means Messiah.
Well, that's the distinction I was going to make. I would have to make a distinction between Jesus, the first century Jew, and Christ, the divine redeemer of later Christianity. I would see Jesus as a loyal Jew, a spellbinding preacher and orator, who won a very devoted following in those difficult days of first century Palestine, suffering under Roman rule in Judea, desperate for God's intervening to free them from Roman enslavement as he had freed them from Egyptian enslavement, and who was put to death by the Romans as a potential troublemaker. The historical Jesus becomes a Jew who tried to teach people that freedom from slavery is a spiritual and not a political liberation. Christ of later Christianity, perhaps the most accommodating view I could offer your listenership is he was God's instrument of bringing the moral message of the Jewish scriptures to the world. That is, what he did functionally, I can't comment on the historical role of Jesus. What he did functionally, or the theological role, what he did functionally was to universalize the teachings of the Jewish people, to make them the heritage of most of mankind.
Except that in the redemptive role of Jesus and in his sacrificial crucifixion, something very new enters into religious thought, it seems to me.
Well, very old and very new, but certainly something very far into Judaism. The idea of the dying and reborn God, yeah. The idea of the God who redeems. Redeeming is not really a Jewish idea. The sense that we are irrevocably cast in sin and can't lift ourselves by our own bootstraps. There were some Jews who believed that, but very distinctly the minority.
So finally, one difference then between Judaism and Christianity is we are left to our own devices.
No, I wouldn't say that. No serious Jew would say we're left to our own devices.
Left to our own ultimate responsibility.
That we bear a major share of our own responsibility. Perhaps the classic Jewish definition of how we see this is an essay by the late and great German Reform rabbi Leo Beck on classical and romantic religion, where he says Christianity is the great example of a romantic religion in which you surrender yourself to God, and God does the saving. And Judaism is the great representative of the classical rational religion in which you don't surrender yourself, but you summon God to help you save yourself. And I think that perhaps is a clearer way of stating the dichotomy.
Though the difference between classical Catholicism and emergent Protestantism of the Reformation may involve some return on the part of the Protestants to that Judaic sense.
Gee, that's funny. I always saw it as the opposite. I always saw that by the 16th century, the Catholic Church had become similar to the Jewish establishment in the time of Jesus, highly institutionalized, highly ritualized, works rather than faith, and that Martin Luther is not playing the part of the Pharisees. Martin Luther is playing the part of Jesus and the apostles in saying, go back to faith, sola fides, rather than works.
There's a wonderful esoteric debate possible at this point, and we'll go ahead and have it while others listen to these commercials.
This is Extension 720 on WGN Chicago. Now again, Milt Rosenberg.
Thank you, Floyd. Harold Kushner's new book, the successor to his book of a few years ago, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, is When All You've Ever Wanted Isn't Enough. It is just published by Summit Books. It will undoubtedly rise to the very top of the bestseller list within 4 weeks. It will be on the bestseller list this Sunday, correct?
A week from Sunday.
You've been told that that's...
That's right. Zone. Well, you know, the New York Times prints its book review a week before they print the racing results and the baseball results and everything. So I can predict that much more confidently than I can predict what the sports pages and the political news of April 20th will be.
Here is the next caller. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, Dr. Rosenberg, I want to thank you very much for having your very fine guest. I've really been consumed with practically every word he's had to say, but... There was one word that I haven't heard since the inception of this program, and that word was values, or his values. And I'm pretty sure that what the rabbi is talking about would boil down to values. Speaking for myself, that title that he's got of it, I think is certainly what fit about, I would say, about three-quarters of our population when all you ever wanted isn't enough.
I must disagree, sir. It wouldn't fit three-quarters of our population because a good half of our population doesn't feel ever in life that they've got all they've ever wanted.
Well, I'm only speaking from my own experience. I'm a recovering compulsive gambler, and from my own experience, I can say that I never had enough. And knowing the number of alcoholics, drug users, compulsive gamblers, compulsive overeaters, and many other people who are afflicted with not knowing the real meaning of the word enough, perhaps I'm not overstating it. However, getting back to what he was saying regarding how do people really become what they are, good or bad? I would think that the word values, the teaching of values to a child that is, when at a very, very young age, learning by the child of the values and practicing of the proper values would make the entire difference of a person's life from the time they're born to the time they're dead. Because if all life is supposed to be is how much can we consume materialistically, then we're in pretty sad shape. And unfortunately, it seems to me that that's pretty much the case throughout the world nowadays, at least for the haves anyway.
Sir, I think I agree with everything you're saying. We've been talking about values perhaps without using that word. We've been talking about how people have to figure out what their priorities are, how people have to figure out who they are and what they stand for. People have to learn by their own experience if they're unlucky and by sharing other people's experience if they're truly wise, what kind of behavior, what kind of orientation makes them feel like human beings and what kind of orientation makes them feel out of sync with the way God wants us to live. And I think the word values is exactly what you're talking about. And thank you for bringing up what is a key word. By the way, Milt, what I was trying to say with the title is not that a lot of people have gotten everything they ever wanted. I'm writing a book for people who say, I have reasons to be happy. Why don't I feel happy?
Yeah.
May I just take one other thing?
Sure, you're doing so well, I'd love to hear you say more.
You were mentioning Rabbi Schulweis, whom I've had the pleasure of speaking with. I think he's a fantastic person. However, I'd like to mention another rabbi. His name was also a top psychiatrist, Rabbi Abraham Twersky, or Dr. Twersky. And when you ask him about believing in God, he'll give you a way of looking at the lesser of two absurdities. I don't know if you've ever heard that definition.
That's the Dr. Twersky of Pittsburgh, is it?
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I talked to him recently on the phone. We were hoping to have him on this program, but it didn't quite work out. Thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you very much. I really enjoy your program.
Good night.
Good night.
And here's the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm glad that the previous gentleman brought the topic back to the, well, the discussion back to the main topic, because I was going to try and do that. My question, in a way, he answered, and I'd like Rabbi Krishna to try to enlarge on it if he can. The idea that my question was, it is true, I believe, in our lives that we get to a point where we realize that just seeking success isn't the way to go, that we're not finding happiness there. So let's take a step back and look at what we've done. And my question was, why does this always happen so darn late in our lives? But then as he was talking, I'm a teacher. And with the whole thing with values being taken out of the school, with religion, everybody grabbing at values as being a teaching of religion, so therefore let's pull it out. Teaching children, I'm okay, you're okay, no matter what avenue you want to take is okay because you got to do your own thing. Have we, in effect, our generation, robbed these young people of a set of values without even realizing that we're doing that?
Good question. Let me share my own personal
perspective. Okay, I'll hang up and then listen on the radio, okay?
All right, if
okay
that's
with
you
me.
Choose, go ahead.
I am opposed to what is popularly known as values clarification. That is the point of view that anybody's opinion is as good as anybody else's, the point of view that the teacher doesn't know any more than the students do, and that the appropriate discussion takes the form of, well, how do you feel about that, and how do you feel about it, and how does somebody else feel about it, without any feeling being more approved than another. I think that's a mistake. I think children have to be taught that certain things are better than others. I think it's very awkward to have religion in the public schools when not everybody is of the same religion. But, ma'am, we do teach values in the public schools. We teach accuracy. That is, it makes a difference if you have the right answer to the math problem rather than the wrong one. To have good intentions but bad addition lowers your grade. We teach the value of honesty. Do your own work and don't copy from somebody else. We teach the value of hard work. We teach the value of sensitivity and respect for others even if you don't agree with them. I think there are consensus values which should get communicated in the public schools, and that they're not an example of teaching somebody's religion as against somebody else's.
Well, let's thank the caller, and we pause for a last round of commercials, and then directly back to Rabbi Harold Kushner.
Back now to Extension 720. Again, Milt Rosenberg.
Thank you, Floyd.
We've only got a few minutes left. Allow me to pursue some crotchets of my own, or some themes that may have been voiced earlier but not fully developed. And our apologies to those who are still waiting on the phones, but we only have about 4 minutes left. Would this book have been... Suppose you were 50 years older than you are now. Suppose you had been this age back in the 1930s. Would you have felt called upon to write such a book? Or does the world need some basic advice and basic homiletics of this sort more now than it did before?
If I had an uncle, would he like pickles? I don't know. It's a very hypothetical question.
Well, things have kind of gone wrong in some ways, would you say, as compared to a few decades ago?
No, I think things are always gone wrong.
Uh-huh.
My guess, and it can only be a guess, is that this is more a function of my going through midlife and less a function of current events in the mid-1980s. That is, I think the problems, certainly Ecclesiastes faced similar problems, Sartre faced similar problems. Once you get beyond mere survival, once you can put enough food on the table and a roof over your head and nobody's shooting at you, then I think you start to ask, now that I'm alive, what is my life all about?
Then these are issues that arise in an age of affluence, or for the affluent people.
An age
more than they did for your grandfather or mine back in the
show. Oh, you're right. Yes, you're absolutely right. Yeah. No, I can't imagine my grandfather sitting around and wondering what the meaning of life is, partly because he was struggling to pay his bills and partly because he was an Orthodox Jew and it was all prescribed for
him. And it was enough to keep the Cossacks off his back.
That's right.
Yeah. The last theme that really does preoccupy me, I voiced it earlier tonight, is this all sounds fine, and there's much wisdom in what you've got here, of course. It's in the book, which is very richly and beautifully done, and it was in your discussion tonight. But the world is really in such sad shape. I know one could have said that at any time, but the threat of ultimate immolation is still very much with us, and one feels less and less confidence that the masters of the world know what in the world it's all about and have the staying power, have the insight, have the decency, have the courage to serve us properly. And to define life simply in terms of the narrow round of close domestic and human contacts within which we might do some good and within which we might show some appropriate humility somehow isn't as satisfying as if you could also show me a way of doing that on the one hand and also connecting to what the world needs without my indulging any grandiose notions that I can... in essence, save the world.
Milton, with 1 minute left, you asked me for my opinion on nuclear holocaust.
And related matters.
And related matters. I don't know. I guess I'm guilty of that. The same thing happened with my last book. I was talking about it in Denmark the week that the Pershing missiles went into Western Germany. And somebody asked me what my theology has to say about the danger of nuclear war. And I said, I don't know. Nobody's ever asked me that before. I tend to think in individual terms. I tend to think in terms of straightening out one life at a time and let the effect be cumulative.
It's sort of like chicken soup. It couldn't hurt.
It not only couldn't hurt, but, I mean, suppose the world doesn't blow up. What are we going to do with our lives in the meantime?
Right. And it wouldn't do any harm if the great leaders of the world read this book, would it?
I think it would be good if the great leaders of the world bought the book, whether they read it or not.
And the name of that book, which many of you will, of course, want to both buy and read, is When All You've Ever Wanted Isn't Enough, by Harold Kushner, published by Summit Books. With that, we are out of time. It's been a great delight having you here again.
Milt, I hope I don't have to wait till I write another book to come talk to you and your guests again.
Please come anytime you're in Chicago. And with that, good night to all.